And Sisko's in subspace with the silver spoon. The little boy put the man in the moon. We'll get together then, yeah. You know we'll have a good time. I'll kill myself with a hypo spray, and then you go back, and everything's okay.
I don't want to be a Cardassian idiot. We'll abuse the democratic process. We believe that everyone is guilty. We're here to share the propaganda. Live on the station like Garrick. Golda Cat is always coming around in the hopes of getting Kira down. Welcome to the age of obsidian and the age of occupation. We'll control everything you see.
Bajoran woman, stay away from me. Deep Space Nine were once Terra Noir, now it's Deep Space Nine.
Nine and not Terra Noir. Why was Deep Space Nine once Terra Noir? We're just looking for freedom. Journey through the wormhole. Don't get caught by Jem'Hadar.
Founders on the other side.
That's me in Quark's bar. That's me in the hall. Losing all my Quatloos.
Platinum.
Quatloos. Platinum would be better, yeah. Oh, dear me.
All right. Well, you can do this later. Right now, let's do an episode.
We're having fun. You know, fun.
I'm a producer, man.
The fun squad comes in.
The show is the art, man.
The fun sponge has arrived, Bill.
We could go in the funzy. look where that got Tony Stark.
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Red alert! All crew members report to battle stations.
Red alert. Shields up.
What shields?
You're Starfleet officers! Now start acting like it!
Oh, it's just Garrick. Plain, simple, Garrick.
Dax, we might have just discovered the first stable wormhole known to exist.
The wormhole does bring them our way, doesn't it?
Everyone wants a piece of the new frontier.
This will shortly become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. And for Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
Quite a motley crew you've assembled here, Benji.
Listen to The Prophets, a Deep Space Nine podcast. And here are your hosts, Andrew Leyland and Paul Spataro.
Bloody hell.
All right.
There you go.
Well, I guess I'm the bringer-inner.
You're the bringer of wonder.
The bringer of joy. The bringer of joy and cookies. Andy never had soft batch cookies, Paul.
Andy didn't live until he got to Orlando.
And I took
We still have an unopened pack of those.
I can't believe you have not opened those. They would have been gone as soon as I got in the car when you, you know.
No.
Ben and I bought you a pack. I bought myself a pack, too. Ben and I ate the whole pack on the way home. Still have them like 2 weeks later.
We thought it wouldn't be fair to eat them all without Adam, so we brought them home. But then what happened was happened. And we haven't all had time to sit down and actually have a family meal since we got home.
I don't know what the expiration time on those cookies is.
Cookies normally last at least a year.
Well, okay. Yeah, it's true. Remember, you got to microwave them just a little bit.
Yeah. Well, that's what we're waiting for as well. We didn't have a microwave, and I suppose in Florida we could have just left them in the trunk.
Yeah, true. But I did buy them a little pack, a little sample, so they could try them. So, all right, I'm just looking over. So, oh, good, they have a thing at the end where I can read it real fast for the other subplot. About Worf screwing up Odo's investigation.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about it.
Yeah. All right, you ready? Hello, and welcome to the...
Welcome to the Prophets.
Welcome to the jungle! Oh, that's your key track. Welcome to the Prophets. We got things to say.
don't know about that. Welcome to the station? No. The station. Welcome to the station. Knees. Morn's gonna watch you bleed.
No, Worf's gonna watch you bleed.
Worf's gonna watch you bleed. Burr. Little on the station. Welcome to the station.
We got fun and games.
Welcome to Quatch Bar. We got fun and games.
Kill me now.
You can drink anything you like.
Welcome to the station. Welcome to the station.
Ah! My God.
I think a little bit of my soul just died.
I was trying to come up with a parody for Sweet Child of Mine. Never mind. All right. Okay. Nah. Sweet Morn of mine. Morn. What song could we come up with for Morn?
Morning Glory.
Morning
Glory. What's the story, Morning Glory? No, we need to change that, though.
Thinking like a Johnny Cash song.
Singing Morning Has Broken.
Morning has broken.
Morning
has broken. The hollow sweet. Quark is making him pay off the damages.
No, Morn has spoken. Morn has spoken. But no one heard. No one was there to see or to hear.
Maybe he's like Black Bolt.
No, but when they talk about him on the show, they always talk as if he's, like, quite verbose.
Yeah, he never shuts up.
Yeah. Well, that's what they did in the Deep Space Nine and the Star Trek Online game. When you click on him, it says Morn takes a deep breath, and then the screen goes black, and then it comes back, and your guy's like, oh, my God, that was a long story. But you don't actually get to hear him talk to you or do anything, so...
My favorite personal image is just when Jadzia was talking about how Morn used to have this long mane of hair. I just picture that and it cracks me up.
He was like Axl Rose. He had the big flowing hair. Morn used to be the singer for Space Guns N' Roses, and he lost his voice.
Space Guns N' Roses. Phases and Roses.
You could be mine.
Sounds like the Wicked Witch.
You've
of the
been
West.
Dancing with Mr. Brownstone. Leave me alone. Oh, no, 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 leave me alone. Bow, 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 bow. Little was a little. Oh, sorry.
All your favorite songs from Phases and Roses. Green Girl Slave.
So, okay. Bringing it in, huh?
Yeah. Got it. Hello and welcome to Listen to the Prophets. Today we are covering another exciting, adventure-filled episode of Deep Space Nine. As with me, as always, are my two magnificent... Goran Egnar.
We deal in subspace, friend.
Eric Taranal. Layla.
Do you know when they come up with these names? Do they really just bash a keyboard?
I didn't come up with it. I was reading the names from the show from the other guys.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Mystery Science Theater DS9.
What?
DS9 style.
DS9 style. So how you guys been?
Doing
since the last time we spoke, almost 5 minutes ago.
Don't
peek behind the curtain.
In between these two shows, I had a quick little breakfast. I'm very happy.
Is that Alvin joining us?
Yes, Alvin just snuck in. He's getting his morning breakfast of Ketracel White cat food. So he can, that way he won't rip out my throat in the middle of the night because we haven't fed him.
Well,
need my food, no, man.
He's not going to rip out your throat because of hunger. It doesn't mean he's not going to rip out your throat.
This is true. Yes, we've done some rearranging of furniture where he looks out the window and he's been not very happy with us because he doesn't have his normal places to sit. So
he don't like that, do they?
Yeah, you know, he's been a bit enraged. He's like, he jumped right up there and then he kind of looked down and he looked at me like, "What the
hell is this? Move it back now!
I can't sit here."
He's gonna come home one day and he's gonna be like pushing at the chair, trying to get it back by the window.
The microwave will be pushed off of the little hutch and he'll be sitting there looking out the window. I told you I needed my space. But right now he's being fed and he's happy and quiet. So this isn't an Alvin podcast. This is a Deep Space Nine podcast. So do we have any new Star Trek news from 5 minutes ago when we didn't really have a whole lot of Star Trek news? I guess that's a no.
New.
New. Although I'm trying to think, did they come? Well, you know, we haven't talked about the Deep Space Nine documentary that's being worked on. Have you guys seen anything about that?
We haven't discussed it in depth because honestly, I don't know too much about it in depth.
Did you see the commercial with, the promo that had Jonathan Frakes on it?
Yeah, that was really funny. That was very good. That
he was hiding himself with a false nose with a pair of glasses. Yeah.
Just call me Lonathan Rakes. Very, very funny stuff.
Because he was trying to hide from Patrick Stewart, right?
Yeah, he didn't want Patrick Stewart knowing he was funding a Deep Space Nine documentary.
Closest thing I can think of to Star Trek news of late is I saw pictures last week from Zaki Hassan where he had pictures of himself with Jonathan Frakes, Marina Sirtis, and Brent Spiner.
All right, cool. Where at?
He's in California, so some show there that apparently they were all at. Him and I think one of his sons.
Right, brilliant.
So that's kind of cool. And he said they were, cool. His comments were they were all very gracious. But then this isn't a TNG podcast either.
It's all right. But, we don't really have a lot of new Deep Space Nine news, so we can't just limit ourselves to only that. So, we got to talk about other things.
Mm-hmm. So what do you want to talk about?
Deep Space Nine?
Why don't we talk?
I don't want to talk about it. How you blew up the station. There's another one.
Why don't we talk about Hippocratic Oath?
All right, we'll talk about Hippocratic Oath.
Let's talk about the show, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about Deep Space Nine and everything the show can be. Okay, Hippocratic Oath.
They were designed for one purpose.
We will kill you first.
You are prisoners of the Jem'Hadar.
Engineered for one intent. The killers.
That's all they know how to do. That's all they want to do.
Enslaved as deadly mercenaries.
You're trying to leave the Dominion?
Now, the only way to escape them.
This is our one chance to get out of here.
It's also our one chance to break their addiction.
Maybe to join them.
Chief, I'm not going.
Next time on Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Miles O'Brien and Julian Bashir clash when their runabout crashes on a planet that is home to several rogue Jem'Hadar, because they're going to steal the plans to the Death Star. Their leader, Goran Agar, takes the two captive before asking Bashir to help cure his men of their addiction to Ketracel White, aka cat food, the drug that makes them loyal to the founders of the Dominion. Goranar was stranded on the planet 4 years prior and expected to die when he ran out of his supply of the drug. But he survived.
Do you expect me to talk, Garak Noir? No, I expect you to die.
It's nice that you interrupt my synopsis just like I interrupt yours.
Tat for tit.
Yes. Ooh, whoa. Tit. Oh. Mm.
But he survived and has since never needed it. He concluded that there must be some substance on the planet that cured him of his addiction. No, it couldn't have just been that you're not a junkie. Bashir is skeptical, since the entire genetic structure of the Jem'Hadar has been reconfigured to be dependent on the drug, and the two officers initially cook up a plan to escape. But O'Brien's makeshift weapon is discovered. However, while the Jem'Hadar that still use the drug frequently suggest killing the men for their disobedience, Bashir notes that Gorn Agnar shows unusual mercy, and his conversations seem to indicate independence of thought and character. He begins to understand Gorgar and decides he wants to aid him and his men, but O'Brien is convinced the Jem'Hadar will always be brutal killers regardless of whether they are dependent on the drug or not. They reach an impasse, and Bashir, as the superior officer, orders O'Brien to help him develop a cure by retrieving a piece of equipment from the runabout. O'Brien goes to the runabout, but there he tricks and escapes his guard and obtains a weapon. Meanwhile, Bashir talks to Gorn Agnar to determine if anything else happened to him on the planet, and comes to the conclusion that there is nothing special about the planet that rid him of his addiction to the white, aka cat food. Through some biological fluke, Gorn Agnar was never addicted in the first place. O'Brien finds Bashir, and when he refuses to leave with him, sabotages his work. Dick. Gorn Agnar appears and confronts them, but his merciful ways have lost him the loyalty of his men. And with no hope of a cure, he finds he has no reason to kill O'Brien and Bashir. He leads them to the runabout and asks O'Brien, a former soldier, to explain to Bashir why he cannot abandon his men, even if they would kill him if he stayed. On their way back to DS9, O'Brien tries to explain to Bashir that all his efforts were intended to save him, but the two still don't see quite eye to eye.
We're having a man fight.
On DS9, Commander Worf interferes... Oh, I can't read that too fast. It's just too long. On DS9, Commander Worf interferes with Odo's investigation as he acclimates to living on the station and no longer being chief of security. He finds an illegal smuggler of crystals on the station and discovers that Quark has been dealing with him. And frustrated by Odo's inactivity despite his clear awareness of the situation, confronts the two himself. Idiot. Odo, who had been spying on them, appears and explains to Worf they had wanted the deal to go ahead so that he could track the smuggler and break down the entire smuggling, but thanks to Worf's interference, he will have to settle with the middleman. Sisko explains to Worf that unlike life on the Enterprise, where right and wrong were clear cut, the line is drawn here. Deep Space Nine has many gray areas. The line is drawn there, over here, off to the left, up there, over there, to the side. That will take some getting used to. And there we have the episode. I didn't remember this one either. Much like I didn't remember the last one. So I'm kind of wondering what I was doing in 1995 that made me not really... These things just kind of went by in a blur.
Hadn't you just got married?
Well, we had been married for about a year and we're trying to have kids, so...
That would probably be more fun than watching Deep Space Nine, yeah.
Maybe we were busy. Trying like bunnies.
Dr. Bill, I'm ovulated. Coming!
You right, Sarah?
But Deep Space Nine's on!
Philip, I'm ovulating, Philip!
I want to watch Deep Space Nine, Lizzie!
No, Canadian!
Oh, you do a much better Philip than
Philip,
I do.
Philip, come and pump your seed into me right now!
Oh, I'm on my way, Lizzie!
Oh, God.
I knew I should have drank of.
The Queen likes the reverse cowboy.
Ooh.
Well, all right, I'm cowboy.
Oh, afterwards, it's a ridiculous hat, Lizzie. Yes!
I'm a giant bucking stallion.
Anyway, what did you think of McCrassy Cope? after you'd attended to your manly duties.
It was nice to see that everything isn't all... I mean, because Bashir and O'Brien didn't gel at first, but then they've got this whole, you know, bonding man-crush stuff that's been going on, and it's nice to see that, you know, you don't always agree eye-to-eye with your friends, or, you know, in this case, Bashir has to pull the I'm the superior officer card, and O'Brien's like, yes, sir!
O'Brien should have been in the brig at the end of this episode.
Well,
enough with the, you know, yeah. I know you're my commanding officer, but I'm going to do what I want to do anyway, crap.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you two about this. Who did you think was right here?
Well, there's a lot of gray areas.
Yeah.
The line is drawn over there.
One of the things I liked about this was it didn't tell you who was right.
Well, I think
Bashir was
right.
Own understanding.
See, I think Bashir was right because I think he made a decision to do what he thought was going to be the best for the station and for the Bajorans and every, you know, just the Federation. And he understood the risks. O'Brien kept telling him the risks as if Bashir was ignorant of them. Mm. But I think Bashir knew what the risks were, decided that it was worth taking that chance. And at that point, O'Brien had to get in line. You know, I mean, this isn't a commanding officer that's asking him to do something. You know, he's not asking him to break the Geneva Convention or something here. He's asking him to do something that's totally within his rights to ask him to do. So for him to then just say, well, I'm going to do what I want anyway. I don't care that they're friends. There should be repercussions to that.
But O'Brien has seen combat and Bashir has not. And I think Bashir's, I don't want to say altruism, that's not the word I'm looking for, but
idealism
kind of blinded him
with science
to realities. It's another song we could do. blinded him to the fact that you know, I think that O'Brien was seeing more behind the scenes and how the men were kind of being rebellious towards their leader. Regardless, I don't think they would have found it in time, and you know, that's what I think O'Brien was seeing. Even if he had let him keep going forward, I don't think that Gorignar, whatever, was going to be able to keep everybody in line, that they were going to kill them at some point.
That may be true. I'm not telling you Bashir was right that it was going to work out to a happy ending had O'Brien not interfered. In fact, it probably wouldn't have. It probably would have ended up the same way it did end. And maybe that's why Bashir isn't, you know, taking any sort of action against him. But I still think O'Brien is very quick to just take things into his own hands when he disagrees with orders that have been presented to him. And you just can't have that in a military station.
Well, but, see, yes, if you want to follow the Starfleet Code of Military Justice,
I would string him up from the highest yardarm.
Well, he did disobey a direct order from a superior officer. Okay, but there's sometimes that you have to take, you know, there's orders and there's lawful orders. Now, he wasn't telling him to kill a village full of children or something like that, but he is telling him something that this guy doesn't believe. You know, he's like, well, I don't think we're going to, if I follow your orders, I don't think we're going to live. So it's kind of a judgment call there. So, yeah, again, it's a gray area. And that reflects the other subplot going on with the whole thing with Worf is spying on Odo, and he's telling Odo, I mean, he's spying on Quark with all the stuff going down with the smuggler, and Odo seems very nonchalant about it. But in the end, we find out Odo was actually, you know, was the bag of money that was going to be transferred, you know, furred all the way back. Yeah.
See, they're trying, with the A and the B plot here, they're trying to do similar things.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, they fall flat on the face, I think, with the B plot. Because Sisko O'Brien, sorry, and Bashir are off on their own. They have no contact with DS9. They're basically left to make decisions for themselves. And O'Brien is all about not helping the enemy. He considers them to be at war with the Dominion. And he's not going to help the enemy. And we saw in Next Generation, when O'Brien considered the Cardassians the enemy, he was about giving them no quarter. So he doesn't agree with what Bashir is trying to do here. And I think in the situation that they find themselves, I think I side with O'Brien in this particular instance. On the station... Oh, sorry.
Oh, well, no. Now finish that, then I'll come back and think about O'Brien.
On the station, Worf is told, A, by the head of security to butt the hell out, and then he's told by his commanding officer to butt the hell out. At that point, Worf should go, okay, I'll butt the hell out.
I mean, he could still watch, you know, because he likes to watch. But yeah, he shouldn't have interfered.
And if anything, if he was going to take affirmative action, he needed to go through the proper channels. Don't just make the arrest yourself, freaking moron.
Yeah, O'Brien and Bashir don't have that luxury where they are. And Worf is clearly... I mean, Worf has a history of disobeying orders anyway.
Well, part of my outrage is based on the fact that O'Brien also has a history of disobeying orders. You know, enough with...
Do you think?
They keep just forgiving him and saying, oh, it's all right.
Well, now, see, I don't entirely agree with you, though, because I should normally, yes. But there's a couple of places in this show where we've seen that O'Brien is very much chain of command.
He helped that alien that was...
Yes, he did help Tosk off the station, but he also has followed orders when Riker took over Defiant, and Tom Riker told him to get the hell off, and he did. And there's a couple of other instances where O'Brien really has followed chain of command.
That was really difficult there, O'Brien.
Well, I would have done that too. I'd been like, F you! What are you talking about? Why are you being such a dick for? Man, what's up with him? What a douchebag.
I I'm watching this and I'm thinking there's got to be ramifications to it. And there are none. They even address it at the end. Well, I'm not going to do anything about it. Yeah, you know, maybe you should. You know, maybe you'd say, you know, instead of having you court-martialed, I'm just going to have a notation in your folder or whatever. But...
Yeah, because then once it's... Once it's explained, it'll get up to the higher brass in Starfleet, and they'll be like, oh, man, that Bashir guy, what a douche. O'Brien was doing the right thing.
It would
damage Julian's career more than
you don't think Julian, you know, maybe leaving out the O'Brien part of it to some extent. But you don't think that Julian reported about the, you know, the Jem'Hadar that, you know, one had not had the addiction to Ketrasil White and that the others were there?
I'm sure he did report it, but what I'm saying is that if he tried to, you know, throw O'Brien under the bus, that it might have, you know, they might have been like, well, you know, he was also trying to, you know, save you, whatever. Yeah,
I don't think so, because I think Starfleet would have said, well, if O'Brien hadn't interfered, you might have come up with a way of curing this addiction, and it would have solved a lot of our problems, because the Dominion now wouldn't have its army. You know, there is the alternative thought that O'Brien presented that, who knows, maybe they would become more randomly violent without the Dominion to keep them on a leash.
But, true.
You know, I think Bashir had the greater good in mind, whereas O'Brien was thinking, I gotta get the hell out of here before they kill me.
Now, what I was saying O'Brien... because remember when his previous... when he was back on DS... TNG, and his previous commanding officer thought the Cardassians were smuggling weapons, and he kind of went undercover...
Wasn't that Bob Gunton from Shawshank?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they... You know, that was that whole thing to where he was siding up to his former commanding officer, but then he you know... I don't want to say he betrayed him. He kind of talks him, backs him down, but then you find out that guy was right all along. I don't don't know where I was going with that because my wife distracted me. She came by. I was like, what?
Philip, it's time.
Oh, no. Those days are long past.
Philip, take out the garbage.
I'll take out it all.
Oh, Paul does.
Don't we have lackeys for that, Lizzie?
Why, I had a son.
In my mind, I picture Commander McBragg.
Not sure Andy's familiar with who Commander McBragg is.
No, I'm not, but it sounds funny.
Oh, it's from the Underdog.
Look it up on YouTube.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
I remember my days.
Well, I think that's what's interesting about this one, is that there is... Both sides are presented. Neither side is presented to be right or wrong. So you as an audience member are left to make up your mind. And Star Trek didn't really do that a lot. If anything, the Next Generation got far too preachy on what was right or wrong. Well, so I think Deep Space Nine is going that direction.
I think in this situation, and here's where I'm coming back to my point, in a situation where there are shades of grey, the commanding officer or the higher ranking officer has the right to make the decision. End of discussion at that point. And you have the right to try and convince him otherwise, but you don't have the right to just say, I'm not listening. I've decided that you're an idiot and I'm not going to do it.
Andy, remember, yeah. This is the executive producer talking.
Oh, right, okay. So the final decision is his.
Oh, yeah. You see where this is going, huh? Okay, all right. Our sidebar's done. Back to the show. So anyway, Paul, you were saying?
I guess...
I'm not trying to undermine your authority.
There was always the imminent threat that the Ketracel White addicted Jem Hadar were going to kill them.
Yeah.
I don't think there was ever a... situation, you know, where O'Brien said, here's a clear-cut path that we can just leave. And they don't. Every time O'Brien tried to do something, it was filled with very much risk of actually setting them off to kill them. So, it's not like, you know, oh, here's the easy doorway out of here, let's go. You know, it was always, well, here's how I think we should escape, but we have to run this 100 yards during which the Jem Hadar could kill us.
We have to run this 100-yard gauntlet, jump over this fence, cross this stream, go around this, over this, and then we get to where we want to be.
So, and my point is, he wasn't exactly offering a safe haven where Bashir was putting them at risk. They were at risk either way.
And yeah.
Yet Bashir had a higher motivation to his risk. So, you know, and I'm far from an idealist, but I think Bashir was right. Whether you agree that he was right or not, he was still the commanding officer. So he had a right to make that decision.
Yeah, ultimately that's where it comes down to. It's O'Brien disobeys a direct order, and this isn't the first time we've talked about this in Star Trek. And every time we talk about it, we come down on the side of, well, there should have been some punishment for this. The only person we've ever seen be punished for disobeying an order is Kirk.
Yeah, he was punished by giving his
exactly what he wanted.
Dream.
Yeah.
We're gonna really punish you, man. You could be a captain again.
Well, they didn't really punish. It wasn't Riker. It was Thomas Riker. That got, you know, they just kind of left him to rot.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, he stole it.
Riker's just as guilty. Riker, the planet of the androgynous people. Him and Worf blatantly disobey orders in that episode to go down and rescue Amy Amanda Allen from the AT.
That was her?
Yeah.
Wow. I did not know that. Now I feel kind of funny.
So did Will Riker.
Ha ha, funny. But, you know, like I said, it's not that I'm sitting here and saying O'Brien was wrong in his theory. Very well may have been right, because ultimately they weren't able to accomplish what Bashir wanted to accomplish, and even if he hadn't destroyed Bashir's research, I think Bashir had kind of hit on the theory that, yeah, you just have kind of a mutant who was never addicted in the first place.
Yeah, he's a mutation. He didn't he didn't. But had, well, I guess there had been instances to where other, obviously other Jem'Hadar have died because of the addiction to it. But I mean, so I'm trying to remember back to the episode where we had the little Jem'Hadar that came to the station. He wasn't addicted to Ketracel White, though, was he?
Yes, he was.
Was it? Oh, it's been a while since
he was born addicted.
Died.
Like a crack baby.
Hmm.
That's written into their genetic code.
That's how they keep them in line, isn't it?
But was it only when they get to a certain age? Because I don't remember him at first being addicted, but maybe...
I'm not sure about that, but he grew to maturity in, like, 4 days.
Poof. Like a weed.
I don't know if that's a bad thing. Within a week, they could be working and paying the way.
Yeah, Adam's taking way too long to get there.
Yeah, he's taking far too long to go out and get a job.
I think Andy wants to grow his own army.
Of Ketracel White addicted Jem'Hadar.
Well, it would just be phone addicted teenagers. I need a phone!
I don't know what to do without my phone.
I've done that already, so I didn't even have to genetically do it.
What did you think of the Worf plotline then? Did you think it was as big a waste of time as I did?
I took it as them saying, hey, you know what, Michael Dorn's part of the cast now, we gotta write something for him to do here. Why don't we write that he's having trouble, you know, acclimating himself to the different way of doing things? But I didn't think he acted in character. I thought the headstrong way he went forward and made that arrest was wrong. I don't think Worf would have done that. I think Worf would have investigated it a little further before doing that. He would have, because he was talking to Odo. He would have spoken to him about what's going on and why. And I don't think Odo was written right, because I think Odo would have said, you know, something bigger is going on here. You need to just stay out.
Well, but maybe he doesn't know Worf enough yet. He is a Klingon. There's been tensions with the Klingons.
They try and explain it away with Odo saying, well, I thought that you're doing what you're doing would give it a more of a sense of realism. Well, that's kind of dumb, too.
Well, this is kind of a joke when I say this. Maybe Worf was just bored. Because he really has nothing to do right now on the station. So he's looking for something to do. Like, oh, what's going on here? Like, he's a busybody. He's like a Klingon, Mrs. Kravitz from Bewitched across the street.
I think the point they were trying to make was okay. Things are different here than on the Enterprise, and you need to realize that. I think that was fine. The message was fine. Just the way they delivered the message seemed very heavy-handed. And then you had to even follow it up with Sisko, you know, reading the moral of the story to him.
Yeah. God, yeah, that was awful.
Yeah, in case you watching this are too stupid to realize, things are different here. This isn't TNG.
Yeah. Very, very sad. All told, though, that's the most interesting stuff about this one, isn't it? The moral ambiguity of it. Who do you think was right or wrong? It's provoked an interesting discussion, but I don't know that it's an episode we'd go back to. I think it does get referred to at some point in the future, but I don't specifically remember where.
I have some question about, what's his name, Goran Agar, because he was not addicted to Ketracel White. And they kind of make it that as that leaves his system, he becomes more clear-headed, more independent, and more willing to assert his own will.
Yeah. Well,
but he wasn't addicted to it in the first place. And they do...
But it may have given him a euphoric feeling. I think he still went through some withdrawal symptoms, and it may have clouded his mind, and he only thought clearer once he was not addicted to it.
But they also make it... You know, as I understand it, that the Jem'Hadar are genetically trained not only to be addicted to Ketracel White because that keeps them in line, but that they have an innate love and respect for the Founders. That's part of their system as well.
Yeah, but is that due to the drug?
Well, that's what I'm asking. I don't think it's supposed to be due to the drug, because that was... You know, that was there with the... When we had the baby Jem'Hadar, he had that already. You know, when he saw Odo, he went right for that. So does the lack of addiction to Ketracel White then clear up those feelings as well, which, you know, that's what it's presenting as a hypothesis in this episode, but I'm not sure that that follows through with what we know about the Jem'Hadar at this point. And then, you know, if you take that a step further, you also think, well, if these other Jem'Hadar, whatever they were, four of them, I guess, if they all became unaddicted, that doesn't mean they're going to fall in line and have the same moral code that Agar has anyway. They're going to develop their own moral code, and their moral code might be, I hate humans. You know? So, I think there was a lot of ambiguity there.
I don't know if I just missed it in the episode. So if Gorn Agar is no longer addicted, how did he hide that? Or did he? What did he?
I don't think he hid it.
Why would they allow that? Why wouldn't they just kill him?
Because if he's commanding officer.
No. I'm talking about the Vorta. How did he hide it from the Vorta? Like, how did nobody higher up in the chain of command realize that he's not taking his drugs?
Because he did take his drugs. He just, when he came to that planet.
I didn't realize that he was still, I thought he...
When he came to that planet, where there was no Ketracel White, he went through the period where he thought he was going to die because it was gone, and didn't. And he came to the conclusion that there was something on the planet that cured him of his addiction, and that's why he wanted Bashir to...
Right, but when he went back to the Dominion, did he hide the fact that he was no longer addicted? Because you see, his tube has been ripped out of his where the drug, like, did he then go, like, because it was 4 years that he was on the planet or whatever, and then I guess they found him. Like, somebody had to have found him and picked him up, and then it would say, hey, how did you live this long? Without any
clean living.
There's like a plot, there's something missing here. Somebody should have seen, hey, he's not taking the drug anymore, or how did he live here? And that's what I'm saying. I'm surprised they didn't just kill him outright, because he's no longer under their control. I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Yeah, it's a small plot hole, but it's a plot hole just the same.
Yeah.
You know, this is where we get into the Listen to the Prophet's Nitpicker's Guide, because that's what we do.
Is there a Nitpicker's Guide for Deep Space Nine?
I believe there is. I do not own one, but I believe there is.
I wonder if that's in there.
Have you got one?
No, I don't.
I have the Nitpicker's Guide. It's been so long since I looked at it. It's either the original series or TNG. I have one of them. But I haven't looked at it in so long, and whichever one I don't have, I had taken the other one out of the library or something, so I've read through both of them. But I do not have the DS9 one. I'm pretty sure there is one, though.
Okay. Yeah, I'm looking it up right now.
And then while you look it up, I'm going to touch on Dwayne Dibley.
See, Paul may not be aware of that one.
Paul won't get that, though.
Okay, so
That's a Red Dwarf reference.
Blaine and Dwayne says...
Paperback for $1.27.
Oh, get it, Paul, Bill.
Kindle $11.99, I can get a hardback. I can get a paperback for $1.27. Which do you think I'm going to do?
Well, what's the shipping and handling on that, though?
$1 million.
That's the only thing you got to look at on those real bargains.
My daughter has Amazon Prime, so it should be...
Is it an Amazon Prime book, or is it a independent seller which does not fall under Amazon?
I'm independent. I don't know.
Independent sellers. If it doesn't say Amazon Prime on the page, then you will pay postage.
Oh, well, new is $14.95. I would imagine the new ones is probably free shipping. So.
Yeah, so you can pay $14.95 and nothing for shipping, or you can pay $1.27 and $15 for shipping to get one that's kind of creased at the spine and beat up. So Blaine would say, "Hi, guys. This is where we start getting a concerted effort to improve the character of Bashir. Instead of the socially clueless womanizer, we see the dedicated doctor who also sees the big picture of the tactical advantage of getting the Jem'Hadar out from under the control of the Dominion. I also like the way Worf is single-minded in his view of how a security chief should work and ends up screwing up Odo's sting, ultimately because Odo just chose not to explain himself to Worf. We needed that to see Worf grow into his new role and out of the shadow of TNG. Blaine. So, Blaine didn't really tell us where he falls overall in the episode. Did he think it was great? Did he think it sucked? Did he think it was somewhere in the middle?
Well, there's also, does Odo have to explain himself to Worf?
I think he needs to do something just to make sure that Worf isn't going to screw him up. I don't think you would anticipate that Worf would go off and make the arrest of himself like he did. So I can kind of forgive Odo that mistake. But I do think there's the risk that Worf is going to somehow scare somebody off or something. You know, this guy who's buying or selling the thing to Quark, if he's aware that Worf is looking so closely, he's a small potatoes guy. That's the whole point, is that Odo's looking to get the bigger guy. The small potatoes guy might be scared off by Worf.
Yep.
So that's I think that's a miscalculation, that they just kind of say, yeah, go with us on it.
But also, if it gets out that Quark is letting Odo bust this guy, that doesn't do Quark's reputation any good, does it?
No.
Yeah, no, not at all. And I'm not so sure. Well, Quark, I'm sure, was being offered something. You know, if they had been able to make the ultimate arrest, he was going to be allowed to keep that thing or whatever. Because he wouldn't do it just out of, you know, a sense of honor. You know, there had to be something more to it than that. I guess we're at the point where we should rate this.
Okay.
It's good to how you think this out in advance.
Well, yeah. I never think anything out in advance. That's the way
I roll, man.
See your pants kind of guy.
Well, I mean, you know, because I'm thinking a little bit about our discussion. Our discussion hasn't raised the episode in my eyes, but hasn't really diminished it either. I mean, it's...
But it hasn't affected it.
Exactly. Was it bad? It wasn't good. It's not, like, I'm just going to give it... For me, I'm going to give it a 3. Three spent vials of Ketracel White. A.K.A. cat food. The Jem'Hadar eat cat food. It's delicious. It's not... I kind of remembered it. I mean, it does have long... You know, it does further the story, but it just... I don't know. There's just something about it. It just wasn't as good as I'd hoped it was going to be. But that's just my opinion.
Well, next. In your rating, you're supposed to give us your opinion. That's part of the process.
Well, that's my rating, and I'm sticking to it. It was okay. It's all right.
All right. Yeah. That's pretty much where I fall. It was okay. I like the ambiguity of it, and that they didn't come down on one side or another. And it's going to be interesting to see if it does have any ramifications going forward, because I think I vaguely remember that it does. But the B plot was crap. So I'm going to go straight middle, 2.5.
Okay, I'm falling in with Dr. Bill on this, shockingly, and I'm going to give it a 3.0. I think, you know, the overall story was interesting. It brought up some questions. It made you think a little bit, even though I don't necessarily like some of the logistics of it. The B plot felt like it was out of a sitcom.
Yeah.
So I can't really give that too much credit. So that the B plot actually brings it down. I think I would be a 3.5 on the main story, but the B plot just kind of struck me as dopey. You know, I could see Abbott and Costello doing that.
So you just want to, like, put a laugh track in for the whole B plot? You know,
yeah, you almost could. It just didn't ring true, and it had some forced moments to it. You know, it was a very special episode of Blossom. So I'm going to go 3.0 overall on this episode as well. It wasn't that it wasn't entertaining. It was, but just didn't quite get me there. So that's Hippocratic Oath, and now is the point where we move on to A Stitch in Time. Because you know what? We have no email.
Ooh.
So we are up to Chapter 4 in A Stitch in Time, and at this point, previously on Listen to the Prophets, you know, we're still listening to Garrick reminisce a little bit and talk about, you know, just kind of setting up where he is and what he's doing right now. So, Chapter 4 goes something like this. Entry. The Bamarin Institute is located in the highlands adjacent to the Mekar Wilderness, a hot and arid area with sublimely beautiful rock formations and an endless network of subterranean caverns. At first, the landscape was foreign, even threatening to my city mind and body. The seemingly endless skies and empty vistas, empty, that is, of man-made incursions, made me anxious. The Institute itself also made me anxious. Every waking moment was planned and accounted for. The Cardassian educational system is dedicated to the ideal that every generation needs a coterie of leadership, an elite in every segment of society. Artists, soldiers, politicians, scholars, and business and tradespeople all have appropriate institutes where they're sent at the age of emergence. At that point, he or she is identified and assigned to live and study apart from family and home for 9 years. The course of study is divided into three progressive levels. Each 3 years, one either advances from one level to the next or returns to serve society in a necessary but relatively humble position. If a person makes it through and completes the third level, he or she is then placed in the ruling vanguard of that segment. My first day set the tone for my new life. After the orientation for the incoming students, at which the first prefect, the head of the institute, likened us to the missing pieces of the mosaic of Cardassian civilization, the adults handed us over to upper-level students, who promptly separated us according to gender, stripped us of all personal possessions, gave us our scratchy drab uniforms, swamp green and black, is it any wonder I ended up as a tailor? And assigned us to living quarters consisting of 10 narrow beds, each connected to a private compartment for our few belongings and an adjoining tiled room for hygiene. For the next 3 years, with the exception of our instructional docents, we rarely came into contact with adults. My childhood was indeed over. I was assigned to the Lubic group, level 1, and my numerical designation was 10. From that moment, I was no longer Elam Garrick, but 10 Lubac. And we were sternly warned never to refer to ourselves or to each other by anything other than this number/group designation. We were the missing pieces, and in order to find our place in the mosaic of civilized society, we had to be broken down and reconstructed from the bottom up. 10 Lubac! And the person who began this restructuring process was our section leader, one Tarnal, a physically powerful third-level individual with a thick neck and a close set of eyes. Yes? Yes, section leader. I was instructed to go to the stock room and bring back implements for cleaning the hygiene chamber. After he gave me directions, he told me that I could take as many of my section mates as I wished to accompany me. I was somewhat confused by the offer, but I thought it was a test of my self-reliance and replied that I could hand the errand by myself. Then go. After wandering through what seemed like a labyrinth maze in which I saw other new students on similar errands, I finally found the stockroom. The door opened and a student my age came stumbling out with cleaning equipment, looking very untidy. He gave me a quick and fearful glance before he disappeared down the corridor. He should be punished for his appearance, I thought. Next! A distinctive and gruff voice shouted from within. I entered and was surprised by the enveloping darkness. Hello? I hesitated, afraid of stumbling into something. Did you come alone? The gruff voice asked. Yes, I came for the... Before I could finish, a hand grabbed me by the hair and the lights went on. Facing me were three older students, perhaps level 2. Why did you come alone? The gruff voice was behind me, along with the owner of the hand that held my head from facing front. When I tried to turn, the hand painfully tightened its grip. I thought that... You thought only of yourself. You didn't think of the group. From now on, you're going to learn never to think of yourself as apart from the group. At which point, I was punched and kicked several times. I tried to resist, to fight back, but there were too many of them. I went down on my knees, trying to catch the breath that was knocked out of me. Clearly overpowered, I refused to cry, and I refused to concede defeat. I would die before I would do either. Enough, the gruff voice called out. One of my attackers pulled me up, and another handed me two buckets filled with cleaning solutions and implements. Take them and go back to your section, and remember, Ten Lubeck, this is what happens when you separate from your group. All individuals are hunted and punished. By yourself, you're pudding. We're going to be watching you. I was pushed towards the door, and the lights went out. The door opened, and as I stumbled through with the buckets, I nearly bumped into another student who was waiting to go in. We looked at each other, and I recognized the disapproval on his face. I thought of warning him, but something told me to return to my section. I hurried past him and heard the gruff voice call out, "Next!" And that's chapter 4. Next time around, we'll have chapter 5. But what else will we have next time, Andy?
You want to talk about it just a little bit? I mean, Garrick is kind of, he's gone. He's off to school, this nice little Cardassian school, to where if you don't pass all the levels, or like if you get bumped out of one, you become a janitor. You become somebody useful in life. You know, I mean, they pick what your whole life career is going to be just by what they've determined you're adept at just from your young childhood, which is, you know, I mean, it's, I like the book because it you know, it's getting into how Cardassian society is structured the way it is. Okay.
Yes.
Nobody else has any thoughts on it.
No, I just had to kind of put together a sentence in my head.
No, we were just thinking.
That's what that buzzing sound is. It strikes me as not dissimilar from what it would be like in a military academy in our own society.
Like boot camp. Yeah. Because you're breaking down. You're not an individual. You have to work as a unit, which is the whole thing with boot camp.
And I like the fact that Garrick is thinking, oh, they're testing me. I have to show I'm independent. And it's exactly the opposite. He came to the wrong conclusion. And did something that it makes total sense, and he got his ass kicked for it.
Yeah, he even looks at the guy that's coming out, going, "Oh, look at that guy. He looks like he's all disheveled and screwed up." And then he has the same realization when he's the one coming out of the room after he's had his ass kicked.
Yeah, which says the guy before him made the same mistake he made. The guy after him made the same mistake that he made, which is kind of cool. It's not, they're not just giving us this in a vacuum. They're saying this is the way it is. And I think the way he wrote this book, you know, he's giving us a bigger picture while showing it from an individual point of view, at least in this chapter. And I like that. I thought this was entertaining in its own way. And yet, while I've never been to boot camp and I've never been through any similar experience, something that you can kind of, you know, you can say, okay, that makes sense. I could see that. It's not something that seems totally alien to us.
Right. Although, you know, and oddly enough, that gruff voice that calls out next sounds a lot like that voice on Back to the Bins. It says next. When we interview, that's you.
Yeah, I'm the man of many voices that all sound the same.
Ah. So, we've got two more chapters, I think, that we'll be reading, and then we'll be getting into the synopses. Actually, I just looked at 7. 7's pretty short, too. Maybe 3 more. 8's kind of short, too. Oh, wait.
Maybe 8. Maybe we'll split 9 up. Maybe we'll do 9.
No, 8 is where it actually starts to get long, so.
Oh, okay.
So, now, and sorry that I kind of, I just wanted to discuss.
No, I agree. I think you were right. We should discuss it a little bit.
No,
we shouldn't just present it.
No, you are fine.
What are we doing in 2 weeks?
Next time, our new episode. Listen to the prophet Kira and Gul Dukat are caught in an indiscretion.
Ooh. Wow.
Star Trek does porn.
A hopeless rescue.
It's 6 years since Aravanok disappeared. Odds are everyone on board is dead.
A hidden agenda.
If my daughter is still alive, I have no choice but to kill her.
A buried past.
If you hurt that girl, I'll kill you.
Now a deadly hunt begins.
DuPont!
And Kira is the child's only hope.
Father?
On the next Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
See you all then.
Bye.
You take bye, Bill.
Oh, bye.
Goodbye, Bill.
Sorry, I heard a noise outside and I was distracted. It sounded like somebody was beating a rug. What is that? Somebody's doing something outside the front door. Who's making that noise outside? What is that? Nobody's listening to me. I'm alone in a vacuum, ignored by my family.
Listen to the Prophets at Deep Space Nine podcast is a Two True Freaks presentation. It is hosted by Andrew Leyland and Paul Spataro. The music and sound clips used in the show are copyright CBS and Paramount Entertainment. If you like to buy stuff from Amazon, and who doesn't, why not drop by the twotruefreaks.com website, where if you click the little link that we have there, it will take you straight through that site, and whilst it won't cost you any extra, we'll put a few shekels in our tip jar, which helps create content like this. We very much hope you enjoyed listening to The Prophets. Every episode is dedicated to the memory of our pal, Sean Engel.
I meant that. I meant Westworld. Never mind.
Yeah, see, thing is, the words you actually say are what we hear.
Which is weird,
Shut
isn't
up.
It?
Shut up.
You would think we could just be able to read his mind.
You'd think that, yeah.
I tried to read it once. It was a dark, scary place.
It was like a cleaning closet where a guy goes, next!
I said, look at that disheveled building.
All right, I'll see you guys later.
All right, see you later, babe.
All right, bye.